Technical problem.
Tick-tock, it's time for a shock. Are you bored? It's time to get awed.
ABC.
NBC.
CBS.
CNN.
Fox News. Breaking news.
Faking news. The media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
How to keep your sanity while keeping up with the war.
Work at ABC News, work at CNN. To see so many people, colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration, and unconscious of the effect they're having.
Well, one journalist who wasn't a megaphone for the military and isn't today is on the phone with us now here on MediaChannel.org radio to talk about his experience and his career in the media. We do that every week, and the interviews can be found on MediaChannel.org. So welcome, Greg Palast. Greg Palast, investigative reporter. Greg Palast, filmmaker. Greg Palast, commentator. Greg Palast, speaker. Greg Palast, someone who nearly died a few weeks ago under the knife in a quadruple heart surgery. And I happen to have been at the hospital before he went under the knife. And I'm happy to say that he's back with us and brassy and outspoken as ever. Welcome, Greg, from your palace on the island, so to speak, speaking to us on Media Channel Radio.
Hey, Danny, and thank you for wielding the knife there. It was you, wasn't it?
Well, actually, in your blog, you write, "I wish my enemies to take note that my quadruple bypass heart surgery 3 weeks ago was successful. My doctors say I can suit up for dragon slaying in about 6 weeks. Bless you all for your thousands of healing notes and thoughts." How sweet that is, and how sweet to be able to write it, I would think, because when you go through a situation like that, it is something that catches your attention.
Well, let's not get too maudlin about it. My main goal was to outlive my enemies. I mean, that's everything else is a footnote. You know,
well, let's talk about your work, because it does have enemies and it does have thousands of admirers and friends. So let's start at the beginning, Greg. Uh-huh. How did you become a journalist? Was that what you started out to become, or weren't you a lawyer first, an investigator, even a poet?
Even a poet, yeah. Yeah, I mean, before I was an investigative reporter, I was an investigator, which is unusual, as you know, in the, for those who know my work, I work with BBC, and now I've started with Al Jazeera, living in, broadcasting from exile from across the water out of London. But I didn't start out in TV news as an investigative reporter. I started out as an investigator. See, as you know, in America, because the reporters you see on 60 Minutes or on the TV news and nightly news or whatever, they're actors. They're not reporters. They're repeaters of the official line. And they mainly are judged for their acting skills. So they did, like Tom Brokaw, the great journalist of the greatest generation. He was the weatherman in Los Angeles, but he had great teeth and invincible hair, so he became the national news anchor. But he was a weatherman. That was his training. I before investigative reporting, I was an investigator.
What does that mean to be?
What does that mean
to be an investigator? You worked with law firms on lawsuits. You worked for government agencies. You worked for the city of New Orleans. Tell us about that.
I did some of the biggest. I did the biggest racketeering cases ever brought by the government, and multi-billion-dollar cases, including, for example, for those in New York, the Shoreham nuclear plant, which is basically a conspiracy masquerading as a nuclear plant construction project, and for the working with the federal government and local governments, I directed the investigation and the case, which won a $4 billion, almost $5 billion judgment from a jury the politicians worked their way into that one and cut it back down. But we did shut down a nuclear plant, the Shoreham plant, after it operated one single day, and put this criminal enterprise called Long Island Lighting Company out of business, and it's now a publicly owned system. That's one. I also directed the investigation of the Exxon Valdez breakup for the people that owned the shoreline that was destroyed, the natives of Alaska. And I've done, you know, other massive racketeering cases involving power companies, oil companies, et cetera.
So what is involved in being an investigator? What are the skills that you kind of honed and used? What are the kinds of questions that you learned to ask? Obviously, you're investigating people who don't want to be investigated. So, information is not necessarily there for the taking. You have to find it, and you have to take it.
Yeah, I know. If you read my book, Vulture's Picnic, or watch my films, you may get the idea that being an investigative reporter mainly involves cool stakeouts at dawn and wonderful flying to exotic places and spending a lot of time with comely women without their clothes on. That's part of the job, but it's not the daily fare. Most investigative reporting and investigating before I became a reporter means figuring out how to get into the underpants of the filing cabinets of these guys, getting the inside documents and decoding the things. Because let me tell you, Danny, when you get so-called smoking guns that I sometimes see in cases that say, "We did it," signed Morty, those smoking guns like that don't exist. They need to be not only uncovered, but decoded and understood. And sometimes it takes weeks, sometimes it takes months, and sometimes it takes years of investigation to get the inside documents that they don't want you to see. That's my specialty, is finding confidential documents. And people wonder, how come I always, in fact, I had one well-known so-called reporter say, how could you get all these confidential documents? I mean, no one gets that many confidential inside documents. The answer is because I'll make use of them. I mean, if you walk into ABC News tomorrow, even 2020, and say, "I have inside stuff," they'll say, "So what? What are we going to do with it?" You know, they want it preached. Where's your PR man? Where's the law firm that's already done the work?
As a former 2020 producer,
yes,
I was prepared to take a front at your suggestion somehow that ABC News is not interested in the news. But actually, when I worked there, there was a term that I learned that I really hadn't heard before, namely the olds, as opposed to the news. And what I was basically told is, we're in the olds business. We want to find stories that have already been done, and we can redo them our way. So the actual investigating that goes on is at a minimum. I was part of the team that on the 10th anniversary of 2020 that investigated the investigations that 2020 had done over the earlier first decade of its broadcasts, and particularly Geraldo Rivera's work and the work of other investigators there. And the whole idea was to create a piece that really patted 2020 on the back. And what we did is we looked at all these reports, we tried to find out what actual changes had they produced in the real world. And frankly, they were hard to find, hard to identify, and harder to brag about.
Well, because they weren't doing original stuff. I mean, you go to, like, if you look at your 60 Minutes reports, how many have actually breaking news or just repeat a story that someone's already done? Or even if it's so-called news, it's some lawyer's already brought a case, or a prosecutor's already brought a case, and they're basically using 2020 for their PR operation or 60 Minutes for their PR operation. And when I do BBC, the program called Newsnight, we break original stories based on inside documents, inside witnesses, and by the next day it's all over the front pages of every newspaper in the world, except in the United States, of course. And, for example, I mean, for those who don't know Greg Palast, one of my biggest, better-known stories to Americans is back in 2000, when George Bush supposedly beat Al Gore in Florida by 500 votes, I uncovered that there were tens of thousands of black people who were removed from the voter rolls before the 2000 election. They were accused of being felons, not able, you know, not supposed to vote. But their only crime, and I mean there is no exception to this in the entire list of 56,000, their only crime was voting while black. That's what determined our presidency. I put that story on the front page of The Guardian, where I was also an investigator, where I had an investigative column.
Well, was it picked up immediately by the New York Times and the L.A. Times and the Chicago Tribune, and did they run with it?
And we put it on the top of the nightly news. And even Noam Chomsky said, I don't understand. He's in India. He says, it's on the front page of the news in India. How come it isn't all over the American papers? I was saying, Noam, this is Noam Chomsky. I'm not kidding. He actually did write me this note. I said, Noam, the news in America is manufactured. This is organic news. We actually created it from the original files. And yet, no, it was not picked up in the United States. The L.A. Times is very proud. This is very interesting because I wrote a piece. I actually wrote a piece in the L.A. Times years later about why weren't these stories picked up? Why isn't investigative material, why isn't there fresh, new, raw investigative material in U.S. papers? And the L.A. Times editor did say to me, well, we covered it. What they covered was not that the BBC and The Guardian discovered that the election in Florida was fixed, and here's how they did it, through this racially poisoned purge of black voters. Rather, they said Democrats accuse Republican officials in Florida of removing black voters wrongly, and Republicans say it's not true. First, you know what? That's not what happened. I never talked to the Democratic
Party. But isn't
that
the way? Isn't that the way a lot of news is? In the interests of objectivity, supposedly, in the interests of balance, it's turned into competing arguments that tend to neutralize each other.
And right.
if you haven't really gone into it in any depth, it appears right. One side says this, one side says that.
Yeah.
The truth must lie somewhere in the middle, if it lies at all.
And so, and very important, and again, I'm praising the L.A. Times, at least they covered it. And then later the Washington Post covered it this way, too. The NAACP, after we ran our story, sued the state of Florida, which, by the way, admitted in court that they wrongly removed tens of thousands of black folk and said, we'll never do it again. Oh, are we sorry? While they're laughing at Bush's inaugural. This was done by Catherine Harris and Jeb Bush, the president's brother, right, who was governor at the time. Now, the way the Post, the L.A. Times ran it and the Washington Post ran it at all, the New York Times wouldn't touch the story whatsoever, but the Post and L.A. Times said, well, again, the NAACP has filed a lawsuit because they followed on. In other words, it was safe. They're not even saying it's true. They didn't uncover the story. They didn't investigate the story. They simply said, they're simply reporting that the NAACP filed a lawsuit, and Florida officials are saying it's baloney.
Okay. Let's get back for a moment to this narrative that I find interesting. You're an investigator.
Yeah.
You're working for agencies. You apparently also work for the city of New Orleans,
yep,
whose mayor just was sentenced to 10 years in prison.
Good.
You know, you were on the inside,
yep,
but not necessarily in a high-profile way. What turned you from that into a reporter, and why did you end up in London?
Well, I was floating in a canoe in Alaska in the Prince William Sound. I kid you not. And I was directing the investigation, the Exxon Valdez breakup. And the story that every single newspaper and the petroleum broadcast system, PBS, ran was that a drunken skipper of the Exxon Valdez, a guy named Hazelwood, Captain Hazelwood, the poor schmuck, he was drunk and he ran the tanker up on a reef. That's a complete fabrication. It's nonsense. It didn't happen. He was nowhere near the wheel of the boat. Yeah, he was drunk, but he was sleeping it off below decks. The problem, there were many problems, all involving massive fraud and what we call and racketeering conspiracy. That is, and when I say use the term conspiracy, I mean it in the strict legal sense of people doing, as a group, doing things together in secret against the law and against the public
will. Well, you know, just on that one point, you know that the idea of conspiracy theorists, okay, however popular to people who accept in conspiracies of various kinds or believe in them, is a way to get yourself taken very much not seriously by a lot of people because it's almost an epithet. You know, you're a conspiracy nut.
Yeah, and muckraker. So if you're a muckraking journalist who's an I was the Justice Department's expert on conspiracies. I mean, because it's against the law, right? That's what I was paid very, very well to
do. I think the
point
that you're making, though, has to be explained and underscored in a way that our government does recognize conspiracy as a crime. People are prosecuted for committing conspiracies. This is not something that's made up. This is not something that's a psychological problem that certain individuals have, you know, delusions of grandeur and the like, but serious empirical evidence exists of institutions conspiring to advance their interests by engaging in illegal practices, and they get caught, don't they?
Well, less and less. That's why I kind of quit as an investigator, because what happened was when I was directing the investigation of the Exxon Valdez, the conspiracy and fraud elements, what I found is, number one, the ship's radar was turned off on the Exxon Valdez for Exxon to save money. Okay? They don't, that makes it a, that means that, that Exxon, to save a couple bucks, endangered the entire coast of Alaska. Then, on top of it, the real villain, and this is, will be, on, you know, people, most people have no idea of this, the real villain in the Exxon Valdez breakup, despite the name Exxon on the ship, was British Petroleum. British Petroleum.
BP of the
BP.
Gulf disaster.
The same one.
Infamy.
When I saw the Gulf disaster, I said, they're at it again. And the reason we have a Gulf disaster is that the disaster in Alaska, BP never paid a dime for that. Because here's what BP did, to give you a few examples. The ship hit at a place called Bly Reef, you know, named after Captain Bly of Mutiny on the Bounty. It hit at Bly Island.
You can't make this stuff up. Okay, go ahead.
You can't make this stuff up. So it hit at Bly Island. That's where it ran aground, because the radar was turned off. And then it ran aground. Now, ships run aground all the time. Tankers run aground. It doesn't destroy thousands of miles of coastline, poison millions of birds, and destroy people's lives. What happens is that just each tanker is supposed to have something that's akin to a fire department. They have emergency boats that surround a stricken oil vessel with a bunch of rubber called boom, and they have these sucker ships which suck the oil out. So you put a rubber on, you suck it out. It's not rocket science. Here's the deal. British Petroleum said that they had the emergency ship and the equipment at Bly Island. In other words, it's almost as if someone started a trash can fire in front of a firehouse. It should have been out in minutes. They should have had that ship surrounded within half an hour. You would have never even heard about the Exxon Valdez, except that instead of there being that emergency equipment and the emergency ships right there at Bly Island, BP had lied about it. They said, because who's going to check in the middle of Arctic water? Who's going out there to actually check it, investigate? They promised it. They said it was there. It wasn't there. They made it up. It was like Pirates of the Caribbean. They had a ghost ship that didn't exist. That's BP and the entire corporate structure. The entire corporate structure hid it. And to give you an idea to what lengths they went to hide it, BP had a partner, an oil man named Chuck Hamill, who saw that there were not only that, but saw many problems before the Exxon Valdez hit. He assumed that BP's top executives didn't know about it. He was a friend of the chairman of BP, Lord Brown. So Hamill took the Concorde. He was so shaken up by some of the stuff he saw about BP's mishandling of safety and shipping that he took the Concorde to London to warn his buddy Lord Brown that there could be a massive tanker disaster in Alaska. And what they did was they said, hey, thanks for the information. Then they hired a bunch of ex-CIA spooks and guys from Honduran death squads, I kid you not, to hunt this guy down, try to entrap him with chicks. he's less susceptible than me, so it didn't work. And they tried to, they went through his garbage. They planted the wiretaps. They only got caught because they ran a toy truck through an air conditioning vent during a meeting he had with a congressman.
All right, but
they
see, this
literally
is what...
ran a toy truck with a microphone through air conditioning vents, and they had the unfortunate, BP's guys had the unfortunate problem that they ran the microphone over the top of a secret Navy SEAL operation. So the Navy SEALs thought that the KGB was on, you know, was onto them. This is before the wall fell, right? And
all right, so all of this stuff.
So what happens is
that
BP
let me reel
knew.
You. Let me work with me for a minute. Let me reel you back in a little bit, because in a way, what you're telling us, these stories that sound so amazing, so incredible, almost mythic in their dimensions, kind of classic palace. What you look for in a lot of your reporting are these kinds of colorful details that help bring this to the attention of the public. In other words, you know, for one thing can be said, even by your critics, you know, that you're not boring, okay?
No.
That you really are looking for ways to take complex issues and explain them in a simple and interesting, intriguing way so that they become memorable.
Well, here's the thing. I think that the truth is incredibly entertaining. If you get these details, when you get the meetings of the guys running the nuclear plants and they're literally figuring out how to hide the secret information, the emergency equipment is exploding, and they hide this stuff, it's fascinating. When you get the guys, you know, running the toy trucks through the air conditioner vents, spying on whistleblowers, these things are entertaining and colorful, so which also raises the question, you can't say they keep this stuff off the air in America because, gee, no one will watch this, as opposed to these boring press conferences with the president or listening to John Boehner, you know.
One of the more exciting politicians of our age.
You know, Rachel Maddow, saying that Obama's cojones smell like raspberries is somehow exciting and interesting. I do exciting, interesting reports because the truth is just that.
All right, but let me just say, it takes a certain way of looking at the world to even realize that beneath the surface, there are all of these crazy personalities, there are all of these dark subjects that are subjects that are worth exploring and investigating. And that takes not just an analytical mind, but a literary mind, somebody who has a knowledge of literature, a knowledge even of poetry. Tell me about that, because that seems to also have influenced your worldview. So that when you look at things, you don't just give me the facts, ma'am, type approach. You say, tell me a story, and I'll tell you a story.
Yeah. Well, it was Ezra Pound, the poet, who said that poetry is the news for which men live and die every day. I mean, I've always told people, young kids who want to go into journalism, don't go to journalism school, for Christ's sake. They'll teach you how to rewrite a press release. Go take a course in poetry, biology. Do something, get something in your head. And in my case, I had two very, very different paths. One, I learned the ins and outs of finance. I actually was a student of economics under Milton Friedman at the University of Chicago, the kind of, right-wing.
He would die again to hear that. Okay.
Yes, and the other is then while I was a protege of Milton Friedman, I was also a protege of Allen Ginsberg, the poet, in New York. And
studying at Brooklyn College.
I thought that was my best. That was what I spent my time doing just before I moved into journalism, because I moved into investigative reporting after I did these, like I said, I was floating in a canoe in Alaska and say, how come I can't get these stories into the American press, the real story of the Exxon Valdez, the real story of nuclear power in America, the real story of these real conspiracies? How come I can't get them in the U.S. press? I'll become a journalist. I'll write them. And I found I could easily get these stories printed as long as it was in another country. BBC, The Guardian, Al Jazeera.
So in other words, international media is sort of more open to what you're writing about and investigating than American media,
yes,
in a way.
And also, very important, they are willing and they like the idea that I have material which is entertaining, imagetic, interesting, and I learned a lot of that by studying poetry, not by reading, you know, not by, you know, they say, what journalists of influence do? They said, Allen Ginsberg and Charles Bukowski. I was also I can't say, no one's ever a student of Charles Bukowski, but in when I was young in Los Angeles, I hung with Bukowski and learned a lot. I think I learned more about writing and journalism from Charles Bukowski than I ever learned by reading every, you know,
right,
half
so Bukowski,
the stuff that Seymour Hersh wrote.
Bukowski is a kind of an outsider, a rebel almost,
yeah.
You know, an iconoclastic icon type
yeah.
of personality, you know, who had his own way of viewing the world. And in a sense, you've taken that road. You haven't sought, you know, to work for the New York Times and you know and win X, Y, or Z prize. You've
right.
you've taken on subjects in a way that's quite different. And sometimes you've become the story, even when you didn't
yeah.
want to be. And there was a case in England, so-called Lobbygate investigation,
yes.
okay, where you were tracking down some stuff and other people apparently were tracking you down. Tell us about that. Remind us about what happened.
Yeah, this is common. I mean, one of the things I did, and again, you can't do this in the U.S., I set up an entire undercover front. I pretended and set up an entire operation pretending I was a lobbyist for a corporation called Enron. And by being the Enron lobbyist, and I had a fancy suite at the Tower Hotel in London, and I'm representing all these guys from these you know Texas hotshots, I found out that I was able to get recordings and information showing that not only Enron but other U.S. corporations were simply buying up the government of Britain. This is at the time Tony Blair was prime minister. He'd just come up and basically put up the country for sale to the highest corporate bidders.
So by pretending to,
you know, people
by pretending to be a lobbyist, you were accepted in that world, and you know you dress well. Let's give you credit for that.
Yeah.
You're a sartorial example. You act in a very kind of self-confident manner, and so they let you in, didn't they?
Yeah. Well, it was a very elaborate front. I even used I won't say their name, but I used a very a law firm that represented Her Majesty's government. I had a whole operation set up. I mean, it was not easy because you have to, you know, create an entire persona and history and everything from websites to you name it. So it was quite a front. But I never entrapped anyone. I said, you know, like, here's $500,000. What can I buy? I said to these guys, it was kind of fun. I said, listen, I work, you know, they would say, well, we can get this done for you and that done for you because I wanted to break environment. I wanted to bust environmental rules. I wanted Blair, the prime minister, to sign off on things and use his influence back and forth with Bill Clinton at the time, the president. And I say, well, we could do this for you. I say, yeah, but I need evidence. I work with these Enron guys from Texas. They just started wearing shoes 2 years ago. They don't want any BS. They want to see the evidence. And these guys would give me evidence of fixes that they had done, how they had changed and manipulated laws and worked on the inside and got inside information on budgets, et cetera, stuff that in America, you know, if you get caught,
so,
you know, you'd be in the hooscow for.
So you
a
were like Abscam before, you know, yeah. but without the recording devices, you know, a movie.
Well, I did use recording devices. That was the other thing. I had a great amount of tapes. But then, of course, what happened is the corporations and a lot of the corporate media went after me.
Let's wait a second yeah. because I really want you to tell that story about how you were actually. You know, basically described as one of the most evil people in the world, okay, by somebody who Americans later came to know as a prominent journalist on CNN. So we'll get to that when we come back in a minute with more of Greg Palast here on MediaChannel.org. Stay with us.
Wish you were as soft and smmooth.
The world in a minute.
47 stations carry no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is identification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch is Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, by a Coke, by a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
Danny Schechter, your news dissector here with investigative producer, director, reporter, Greg Pallas. And Greg is telling us a story about he set up a false front, a lobbying operation in England, and found all of these politicians basically coming to him to try to, get money from him or through the company they thought he worked for. And then in the end, Greg, you became somebody who they began investigating.
Yeah, it started with the Prime Minister himself attacking me from the floor of Parliament, where he had immunity, so he could say what he wanted, that, you know, I was a liar, that this American was a liar. And then I ended up being on the front page, my full face, without my hair somehow, on the front page of the Daily Mirror, the biggest paper in Britain at the time, whose editor was a scamp parading as a journalist named Piers Morgan, or as he's known in the magazine called Private Eye as Puss Moron. But the Morgan was doing a hit job for Tony Blair, for the Prime Minister. So I'm smeared on the front page as a liar. But that wasn't good enough. That didn't bring down my stock. The public, every newspaper, other newspaper, the public was behind me. BBC and The Guardian were behind me. And so that wasn't good enough. So they tried the old honeypot. if you read my book, Mr. Jamaica, you say, you know, don't, you know, I begin by saying don't, you know, I was at the convention of the Labor Party later that year. And what I was actually trying to pull a kind of a Mata Hari, someone very, very close to the Prime Minister and his henchman, a guy named Peter Mandelson, known as the Dark Prince. They had taken a young woman under their wing. They wanted an African-American on their ticket, so they'd taken her under their wing, very attractive young woman, and she had a bit of a crush on me, and I decided I would take advantage of that to see if I could get some inside information. But then they had found out about it, so they, you know, it was wonderful. They set a wonderful trap. They had her leave a note for me, take my key and go into my room. And, you know, you would think that an investigative reporter and a long-term investigator would smell something wrong, you know, take a key and go into a woman's room, you know, go upstairs to a woman's room. And I almost didn't, you know, but, you know, not only am I an investigative reporter a journalist and experienced investigator and a poet, but I'm also kind of a guy. And so I opened the door, and you could hear the crowd screaming, okay, don't open the door. But if you open the door and go in, whatever you do, don't take off your clothes. And I took off my clothes. That's when her husband came in, who had a look on his face like he'd been there before. And I was thinking, she has a husband? But it wasn't her husband that disturbed me. You know, this is part of the business I'm in. But it was the fact that he was joined by a photographers from the Mirror. So Piers Morgan had all these photographs across the first six pages in the front of the Mirror. And what they tried to do is say that I broke into her room. So, it was, you know, it was a wonderful smear. It was a great, wonderful sex scandal, and try to get me fired from
Unfortunately, it was a sex scandal without any sex.
Yeah, I know. Why couldn't they wait another 45 minutes?
You're telling of it. Okay. But I will say this, and I'm sure you remember the date, July 8th, 1998, when Prime Minister Tony Blair, speaking in Parliament, said that all the specific claims made by you have been investigated and found groundless. Every allegation made in The Observer has been investigated and found to be untrue. Tony Blair, a man who's known for the truth, is he not?
Yeah, and then the next day his office had to issue a retraction. But and normally, unlike the United States, you could actually sue the Prime Minister for defamation, for saying that my report was false. But because he said it on the floor of Parliament, he had parliamentary immunity. But he did have to retract his statement that my report was untrue, because he knew it was true, because I had, what they didn't know at that time, was I had tape recordings, and I had documented evidence, because I told these guys, I need the documentary evidence, and they just couldn't stop themselves from incriminating themselves so badly. It was insane.
All right, so this was an investigation that got a lot of attention, and of course,
yeah,
put you on the front page of a prominent newspaper and mm-hmm. turned you into either a cat or a hero, depending on your point of view, but certainly they didn't like you.
No.
And then something began to change in your approach. First of all, you went from newspapers to working in television. And secondly,
right,
you began writing books that became bestsellers, like The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, Armed Madhouse, Vulture's Picnic, Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. What accounts for that transition in your life?
Well, I had kids, and I didn't want them to be British. I wanted them to be American. But how could I come back to America and write if I can't get, you know, I mean, this is funny. The L.A. Times ran a story about me because I was born in L.A. L.A. boy becomes, you know, the world's most significant investigative reporter. And they ran this big thing about how I'm the big shot investigative reporter recognized worldwide. I said, well, that's great. Listen, since you've now done the work on me that I'm such a great investigative reporter, why don't you hire me to do investigative reports?
Oh, no. Mr. Palace, thank you so much for suggesting that.
So I couldn't work. As the Asia Times says, I'm the best-known reporter, American reporter, who's somehow persona non grata in American mainstream newsrooms.
Well, also,
and so I can't get on the petroleum broadcasts. So I can't get in the New York Times or rest. So I decided what they can't do is stop me from writing books and publishing them, and people can buy, until Patriot Act 3 goes into effect, you can buy a book. So my books quickly became, because you couldn't get the stories otherwise, like Best Democracy Money Can Buy, and the latest in 2012 was Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, these became big New York Times bestsellers. So it's the only way I got into the New York Times is being listed on their bestseller list.
So that itself is very interesting. At the same time, though, there your work did attract critics other than Tony Blair. You know, people on the what we would consider to be on the center right, George Galloway, who of course was a left wing MP and is in England, very well known to viewers of Democracy Now and to activists in the United States, does not like you.
No.
And he said that you conflate meetings, truths and half-truths, statements taken out of context to produce a toxic smear which would be actionable in the country he claims to work in. You and George were not best of buddies.
Well, we were. I mean, the problem is that, and you better watch out, Danny, even the best of buddies, I was one of George Galloway's biggest defenders and comrades. But then, you know, we do investigative reporting, and we don't look at what your political party is or your affiliation or your viewpoint. And after I had publicly defended him on allegations that he had misappropriated money from a charity he was running, we investigated. In fact, by the purpose of my investigation was to help clear his name. But unfortunately, we found out that all the allegations were true. And what should I do? Bury the allegations because, you know, he's someone that is so-called on my side or my view?
Yeah.
I can't. And that's the other thing is that I did an investigation of a woman running for Senate, for the U.S. Senate in New York, Hillary Clinton. And I ran two investigations, one called The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, which is about the money influence on George W. Bush, the same week that I issued a story on Hillary Clinton. And the attack on I was viciously attacked by a feminist organization for uncovering uncomfortable truths about Hillary Clinton in my investigations. And I can't say, well, oh, I can go after George Bush. He's a Republican, but I can't go after Democrats. And so I went after Clinton, I mean, because that was the evidence. And I was viciously attacked for that. And then ironically, 4 years later, when the same groups were backing Obama, the groups that had attacked me started reprinting my old stories about Hillary Clinton. I'm sure that in 2016, that all those reprints will be withdrawn. So I'm just not, you know what? I'm not going to make.
So there is hypocrisy in politics for sure,
yeah.
And there are people who say one thing and do another. I, for one, you know, have had some very nice meetings with George Galloway. I was impressed by his outspoken courage, but at the same time, I know that there are many people in England who don't like him, and many people who feel he's betrayed them. So I'm not in a position to judge any of that, but I do think that you have made it a practice. Even when it sometimes leads to people, you know, criticizing you for you know, getting off the boat, so to speak,
yeah,
and going your own way, I have to say that I respect the fact that you let what facts you've uncovered lead you to certain conclusions.
Well, one of the problems is, and this is another reason why, for example, you might ask, okay, I've done all these attacks on vote theft by George Bush. My co-author, Bobby Kennedy, and I wrote a piece for Rolling Stone back in 12 on how the Republicans were stealing. They still in 12. Obama may have won the election, but still 6 million votes, minority votes, were stolen. You know, so it was, you know, we still had an apartheid election going, and
well,
I ran that story.
You
would think I would be on something like MSNBC or something, but they don't want me on because they don't know if I might say something that doesn't praise, you know, the great Obama, you know, the drone ranger.
Well, you and I know that, you know, we did work together on a film called Counting on Democracy,
yes,
which was, you know, I think I would have to say, you know, the best film on the election of 2000.
It told
your story, and it was, you know, imitated but not, you know, improved upon, in my opinion. But nevertheless, it was hard to get that out there, to get people. And when 2004 came along, now Kerry is running, and we went back to PBS and said, hey, you ran, Counting on Democracy. The issues are still out there. Would you consider running it again? And you know, I was met with a tremendous lack of enthusiasm, if not outright rejection. In actually trying to get these issues of voter rights into the public discourse and public debate. And in many cases, I came to feel that the Democrats were their own worst enemy, or also kind of elitist in their approach, and did not really put defending the right to vote at the top of their agenda.
Well, not only that, here's the problem. When I was doing, and I've continued, and by the way, I'm continuing even now, for Al Jazeera, for The Nation, and for The Guardian to do investigations of vote theft in America. I mean, we still have apartheid elections, and you know, now people have finally jumped on things like voter ID, but that's just scratching the surface of the manipulation and games. But one of the reasons we don't get the story covered, and here's the nasty little secret, at the moment, Republicans tend to be better at vote heists than Democrats. They put more money and computers on the issue. But Democratic hands are dirty. They are bloodied with the stolen ballots of black, brown, and especially Native American people. In fact, one of the problems is, just like all elections are local, so is all vote theft. So that you have a massive amount of vote theft aimed a massive suppression of the vote by Democratic Party politicians. You say, well, wait, those are Democratic voters. not in primaries. Remember, Democrats, you know, remember we have primaries, and Democrats, like, for example, Bill Richardson, the governor of New Mexico, a Hispanic Democrat, and his Secretary of State, a Hispanic Democrat, his Secretary of State was involved in massive vote theft. I caught her. She's now facing a federal indictment and prison time for stealing. She's a Hispanic Democrat for stealing Hispanic Democratic votes. I worked, did a story with one of the, you know, there was a federal prosecutor. You know, if you remember that there were George Bush fired 8 federal prosecutors, and no one seemed to know why. The answer was these are federal prosecutors, all Republicans, who refused to go along with a plan by Karl Rove to use the federal prosecutor's office, use these prosecutors, to arrest legal voters for supposedly being fraudulent voters and scare minority voters away from the polls. They were actually going to arrest innocent citizens. And these guys stood up, but only one went public about what happened, David Iglesias. But I got to tell you, you know, he showed me the Democrats stealing votes from Native Americans in New Mexico. And so I did the story about how Democrats were stealing votes as well as Republicans, and that was the end of my ability to report.
That wasn't
or the liberal press on vote suppression.
That wasn't a big story on MSNBC, I would assume.
But no, see, because it's only now it's true that right now. But remember, it was the Democratic Party that was the party of Jim Crow. Let's not forget that.
So,
and that has never left the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party remains in much of America the party of Jim Crow.
All right, but let's go back to the media here, because you're facing certain choices. What do you do now? What do you do next? You've been on Democracy Now. You've run your own independent investigations foundation. You've published articles in a wide range of different magazines. You've published books and all the rest of it. At the same time, it seems as if our media is getting worse, not better. And more difficult to get other more truthful journalism out there. It seems as if Glenn Greenwald has had some success in getting major newspapers to pick up his stories. But there's, you know, there's only one or two people like that. It seems very difficult.
Well, first of all, not even Glenn Greenwald could get a story into the American press. He had a report like me by effectively going to journalistic exile, writing for The Guardian. You know, why isn't Glenn Greenwald a columnist for the Washington Post? Why, I mean, you know, they would never accept him. Even with the Pulitzer Prize, they're not going to accept him, okay? They're not going to accept Greg Palast. They're not going to accept Danny Schechter's broken, tremendous story, been on the forefront.
Let's hear some more about that on our next
program.
Yeah,
that's really true. So what's happened is that we can't get into the U.S. press. We're persona non grata. It's worse than ever. And by the way, let's not forget that, you know, you might say, okay, who is really one of the few truly recognized, praised American investigative reporters is Seymour Hersh. I was at Columbia University Journalism School with Hersh on a panel. And I talked about how the New York Times suppressed a major story that I did for The Guardian about how George Bush Sr. was advisor to a mining company that had Barrick Mining in Africa. That company had taken over property where the African miners had been buried alive by the predecessor company so that they could sell to Bush's company. Buried alive. I ran that story, and the New York Times refused to run the story because their lawyer and my lawyer, Floyd Abrams, are the same, and he said they are scared. They said, in the U.S., we have freedom of the press, but if these guys sue, it's going to cost $500,000 to defend our freedom. We will win, but they don't want to bother. Even reporting a story of a mass killing, they're not going to do it if it's inconvenient and it costs money. They're not going to do it. And that's one of the big problems
so
we run into.
Tell us what's happened with you now. Are you going to be working with Al Jazeera America?
Well, I'm going to be working with Al Jazeera and probably many other outlets, but I'm very happy both TV and print side. But again, it's a foreign-based operator. You know, I'm trying to speak to my own country, you know, from abroad. This is insane. Even so, Seymour, the reason I brought up, by the way, that story is that when I talked to Columbia University and Hirsch was with me, I told the story of the suppression by the New York Times of an important story about George, the Bush family. A New York Times editor was there and said, this is the first time I've ever heard anyone accuse the New York Times of suppressing a report. Hirsch turned to me and said, that's the guy that had me fired from the New York Times. Seymour Hirsch was pushed out of the New York Times, America's best investigative reporter, our most lauded, and he couldn't keep his job. He had to switch to the New Yorker, which had a British editor. You know, so you couldn't keep these guys. Bill Moyers has told me, you know, Bill Moyers had to leave PBS. His show, the Bill Moyers reports are not public broadcast system. He said he can't work with the public broadcast system. It's a petroleum broadcast system. It's run by Chevron, which is their number one.
So what we're dealing with here are the problems we've been dealing with for a long time: media concentration, bigger and bigger companies taking over the Comcasts and of the world, less money invested into investigative reporting, less money investigated into, invested into actually monitoring the activities of our biggest banks and financial institutions. I certainly reported on that in my film Plunder about the financial crisis, where I show that the media was complicit with the financial disaster that struck America. So, you know, these are the issues that we're up against, and we're trying in our own way. MediaChannel.org is out there trying to offer more analytical coverage of the media. Is that important in your view?
There's always two stories, and they both must be covered. In America, there's the story, the report, the mass killings by a mining company in Africa, the secret documents that I found of the plans to steal the oil fields of Iraq. There's the story, but then there's the story of the story, the suppression of the story. How does it not get into the U.S. news? And then I don't want to forget, I'm not just polishing your apple, Danny, but let's not forget, Danny Schechter is a multiple Emmy Award-winning, Polk Award-winning, he's got every award on the planet, his shelves are cracking with awards, and yet try to get a Danny Schechter report. That's from mainstream TV of years ago. Try to get a Danny Schechter report onto mainstream TV today. Try to get on the petroleum broadcast system today. Forget it. You know, so even a Danny Schechter, a Bill Moyers, Seymour Hirsch, their persona non grata, let alone a Greg Palast.
Managed to persevere, Greg. You do find it both within yourself and within the community of people that support you. Reasons to go on. Now, maybe that's the only thing you know how to do, but it seems like you haven't given up.
Well, people ask me, how can I remain cheerful? I said, I don't. I said, I had a fight. If it weren't for my partner, Jack Daniels, I don't think I could get through any of this. But, it's like, no, it's not always easy. There are moments of despair. You say, why am I doing this? They don't want to hear any of this information. I mean, half the time, I have to have Michael Moore get my stories out. I can't get on TV, on the news, so I give it to a fat guy in a chicken suit. What the hell is that? So what's happened is it's not easy. But again, for me, the only thing that works is that, and I can tell you on the air a story that I told you privately, but it really carries it. Once in a while I say, why am I bothering? Really, truly, why do we bother? And, because it's a lot of work, it's very expensive, it's very risky, because I do get sued again and again, and I get threatened. I've got a new guy, this billionaire vulture, who's threatening, called BBC to threaten me, he's got a file on me, blah, blah, But this is, some of this can be very serious stuff, and very costly, so why bother? And then I was at the doctor. You were talking about my heart surgery. I was at the doctor, and there's another guy there looking at me funny, and I didn't know. And then later he's behind me. I felt my pocket someone kind of seemed to get in my pocket, and I think, is someone picking my pocket? But I had nothing in there. I come home, and there's a note in my pocket. The guy had slipped a note in my pocket, and it said, thank you for telling the stories that people can't tell themselves. You know, so that's it, you know. If I, you know, I have an obligation, just as you do, Danny. You know, there are, when I was in Florida, there was a young guy, Willie Steen, a Gulf War veteran, never got a traffic ticket. He went with his five-year-old son to vote. He wanted to show his son, you know, the great American democracy. And he was told, you can't vote because you're a felon. Simply because he's black. And his name was close to some other guy from Ohio who was in prison or something. So there you go.
And, you know, these are the stories, really, Greg, that people remember and that people admire. And I think the work that you've done and continue to do is something to be admired and something to be challenged by and to argue with you, but also to learn from you. And I want to thank you so much for being on with MediaChannel.org and discussing these issues. We will be posting this on MediaChannel.org. We do want comments and thoughts from others. If you want to write to me, you can write to dissector@MediaChannel.org and give me some feedback on this program and also on the work that we do online. So once again, Danny Schechter, your news dissector. See you next week. Same time, same station.
To chase and to walk.